Hi, everybody. Welcome to Dan Snow's History. This is a very special episode indeed. A few months ago, I went to the Gloucester History Festival. I met two veterans from the British Army's 1st Battalion, the Gloucester Regiment, better known as the Glorious Gloucesters, because of what happened on this river in Korea in April 1951. To mark the 70th anniversary of the battle, I met with Tommy Clough. He was actually a gunner with the Royal Artillery, but he was attached to the Gloucesters, and Brian Hamblett. He served in a machine gun platoon in the Gloucesters, and they were both at the battle. They were both Chinese prisoners of war, as you'll hear, for more than 2 years. The Battle of the Imjin River is probably the single most remarkable, most memorable brigade-sized action that the British Army has fought since the Second World War. In the spring of 1951, a massive Chinese offensive against United Nations forces in South Korea had begun. They were trying to retake Seoul. The front line had been seesawing up and down the Korean Peninsula. We've got several podcasts available on the Korean War, which you may want to go back and listen to, either on this feed or on History Hits TV, our digital history channel, where we have all our podcasts without the ads and all our television shows as well, hundreds of hours of TV shows. So head back and listen to one of those. But we're talking about the Spring Offensive of 1951 now. A massive Chinese force assaulted a section of the UN line composed of Northumberland Fusiliers, the Gloucesters, and other units. The local commander was Brigadier Tom Brodie, and he was responsible for about a 15-kilometre section of the front. The battle that followed had the highest casualties of any British action since the Second World War. It was amazing talking to Tommy Clough and Brian Hamblett in Gloucester about their experiences. As you'll hear, they were irrepressible. In fact, at the end, I have to interrupt them because I was at a live history event and people had to go to other talks. No one wanted to leave, but they kind of had to because they needed the room for another talk. Some poor historian was coming on. Very tough act to follow. I am going to go back to Gloucester. I'm going to interview these remarkable men again for History Hit TV, so you'll be able to watch as well as listen to these fantastic people. If you follow the link in the description to this podcast, you'll get taken to History Hit TV. You'll get 2 weeks completely free. You can check the whole thing out. We've got all the podcasts on there, like I say, and we've got hundreds of hours of history documentaries as well. This was a wonderful experience, particularly after months of lockdown, to get back in the room with two card-carrying legends. So enjoy this conversation with Tommy Clough and Brian Hamblett.
Hello. Hello, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's a great excitement to be back. This is very exciting for me because I was intending to make the most of the Korean commemorations. This is a big, under-understood, under-remembered war in British history. We've got wonderful veterans still alive that we can talk to. And we got the huge anniversary this year and last. And it was all cancelled because of COVID. So tonight's a very special night for me because it's a chance to get in the same room as two legends, two national treasures, to talk about the Imjin. We got Tommy Clough, who was 19 when he went to Korea. Now, he's an artilleryman, and Tommy came up to me a few years ago and gave me a good telling off about the Imjin River, because, of course, I talked about the Glorious Gloucesters, and I did not mention the people that were also there at the battle, the artillerymen, and the Northumberland Fusiliers as well, of course. So tonight is me making up, Tommy.
Thank you very much.
Apologising to you. I promised you next time we'd talk about you, and here we are. Brian Hamblett, you turned 19 on the Windrush.
Yeah, 19th, but already, yeah.
Going out to Korea.
Yeah.
There's so much politics and so much yo-yoing up and down the peninsula. We've got you guys tonight. I think you'll all forgive me if we cut straight to the action. Spring, 1951, 70 years ago. Tell me where you were on that bend in the Imjin River. And what was it like? Tommy, let's start with you.
Well, it started on the 22nd. It started with a patrol of the Gloucesters going down to the river, and we were half expecting an assault because it was time for the Chinese spring offensive. We in Britain, we have a bank holiday, but the Chinese have a spring offensive. It's in their nature, or at least it was in Korea. And that night on the 22nd, a young second lieutenant, Guy Temple, took a patrol down to the river And the expected happened. The Chinese started to cross. And by the morning, the patrol had expended their ammunition and withdrawn, but the Chinese had started to cross the river in force. And that was the thing. We knew what was happening. I was back with my mortar troop. We were supporting the Gloucesters with 4.2 mortars. Very effective for troops in the open.
Tommy,
and we were laying down barrages.
Tommy, tell us all what a mortar is. What's the difference?
A mortar, it's not like a gun. It fires a bomb. High trajectory, as Dan's just described. And it's literally a bomb that's thrown into the air and lands. It's very handy for firing over buildings, mountains, or whatever. And we were with heavy mortars. The infantry had 3-point-inch mortars. We had 4.2 mortars. And, like I say, very effective. And it was a question of kill or be killed. Their casualties must have been appalling because we had the firepower, they had the manpower, and the odds apparently at the time were 7-1 against us, but eventually we reckoned it was 10-1.
Brian, you were one of the infantrymen that he was busy dropping bombs on. Tell me, before the Chinese attack, what kind of perimeter, what kind of defensive posture are you in?
I was MMG, so we were on the periphery.
A machine gun?
A machine gun, yeah, a Vickers machine gun. And obviously we had our fixed targets, like, you know. So we were on the periphery of the battle, really. And we were sat there waiting for...
Is it appropriate to use, are you in trenches? What, are you dug in?
We dug in because we were there for weeks before. I mean, we've been waiting for this for ages, like, you know. And because I've been on a long-range patrol before that with a Centurion. We went 14, I think it was 14 miles. We went on patrol looking for the enemy, like, you know. We didn't see anybody. And we come to this one hill and we all decanted. And well, that was a frightening experience. We had fixed bayonets and go up this hill, like, you know. That was quite an experience. And, well, you grew up then, don't you? You grew up. And nothing there. They must have been laughing at us, like, you know. And we came back, and then a few days later, they came at us.
So tell me about the scenery. You got the Imjin. How wide is the Imjin River?
Well, they forded it, so with that wide.
So you can walk across.
It would be in flood. It would be, obviously it'd be a raging torrent, but I mean.
And there's quite high mountains, aren't there?
Yeah.
Hills, big hills.
Big hills, yeah. I don't know whether they were Monroes or not. I'm not sure.
And are there trees? Because there's trees there now, aren't there?
Well, yeah, but it was decimated before by the Japanese, apparently. We learned this all after, like, you know, that the Japanese had raped the country, really. All the trees had gone.
So you could see, very good visibility, was it?
It was good visibility, yeah.
And what about you, as a machine gunner?
Yeah.
When the Chinese are starting to ford, you must have thought to yourself, well, it's going to come down to me today.
Yeah. But well, unfortunately, we're lucky in that way. Look, you know, we just on the perimeter. So they'd gone round us, hadn't they? So we were encircled in a way, like, you know.
So the Chinese are avoiding obstacles. They're just infiltrating. They're trying to find gaps in the Allied line, aren't they?
Yeah. Because we had such a white front, like, you know, there's the RNFs and the Ulsters were with us and the Belgian battalion. But there was miles between each battalion, like, you know, so there was, you know, they could infiltrate really easily, like, you know.
And could you see them could you see them coming around the edges?
Well, no, I never seen them. No, I've seen a few, but not many, like, you know. But I mean, it's been horrible for the guys who were right in the thick of it, like, you know.
So you could hear the firing.
It's frightening, really. Yeah.
I imagine when you're not in the thick of it, your mind is not as occupied. It's probably just as difficult waiting and not being certain of what's about to come.
That's right, exactly, yeah. And of course, we were always so tired because we stood to before dusk and after dusk and then before dawn and after dawn, and we were doing stags in between, like, you know, so you're all suddenly completely knackered, like, you know, it's always tired, you know. In the end, you get a bit sort of peachy, you know, you just accept it, like, you know, you accept your lot, you just carry on with it, like, you know, and it's a strange feeling, really. But we never had any tin helmets or anything, you know, all we had was soft calf comforters, like.
No protective headgear?
No protective headgear at all, no. Because we had the remnants of World War II, like, we were poorly equipped, really. I mean, well, all this is in hindsight, really, but I mean, you learn so much more after, like, you know, than at the time.
Tommy, what about you? When did you start firing? When did you have to get called up by the infantry to provide artillery support?
Well, the following morning, I mean, the night before, on the 22nd, you see, in the artillery, what you do, you register targets when you can see them during the day. You register a crossroads or a hill or whatever.
You drop a couple of practice ones
on it. That's right, yeah. You fire smoke or whatever, and you register them. So in the evening, when it gets dark, that's when the attacks come in and you can't see them. You can hear them. Their noise discipline at night was terrible. You could hear them chattering as they crossed. But we were called on, it's what they call defensive fire. And we fired on targets at night that we'd registered during the day. The following morning, we could see what was happening. And I was with what they call the FOO, the Forward Observation Officer, with the Gloucesters. He should have put an L on the end and made it fool, but never mind. And we were observing targets, and we were registering targets at 700 yards. Our minimum range is 900, because with a mortar, you've got to be careful. You're firing a bomb up in the air, and you've got to be careful you don't drop it on yourselves, which does happen occasionally. That's why they call us the drop shots. Anyway, I went back to the mortar position, and one of the lads said to me, because they can't see what they're firing at, he said, "Are there many of them?" Now, I didn't want to spread alarm and despondency, but whilst I was with the forward positions, my officer, Captain Wisby, had handed me his binoculars and told me where to look. And I looked between two hills, and I literally, all I could see were ants. But it wasn't ants, of course, it was the enemy. And they were coming across in swarms. And that was their tactics. It was literally cannon fodder. They just came in waves, and Brian will tell you, you just mowed them down. The first wave went down, the second wave came up and took the weapons off the first wave and just carried on. There was no regard for loss of life, as long as they could occupy a position. And of course, with us and the Gloucesters with the infantry. I mean, I saw British infantry at the Imjim at its best. I also saw my own regiment, Royal Artillery, British gunnery at its best. And I'd never seen anything like it before, although I'd been in a couple of battles earlier in February. The support we were given by the Royal Artillery, the 45th Field Regiment, was amazing, because we were in a tight perimeter. We were completely surrounded. And at one point, we didn't know at the time, but we heard later that eventually, we'll come to that, but when we were taken prisoner, the Chinese were 15 miles behind us, heading towards Seoul, the capital of South Korea. We knew we were fighting a battle for survival, but we had amazing support from my regiment, although I boast it. And we also had good support from the American Air Force with airstrikes, which we'd called for. Now, with an airstrike, sorry, you were going to say something?
Well, I'm saying, so when you're firing at 700 yards,
yeah,
are you observing the... So you're able to see where those shots are falling and what effect they're having?
Oh, yes, definitely. Because the thing about a mortar is, it's not very effective, the bomb, with people in trenches, unless it falls directly on the trench. But it's very good at troops in the open.
Is it bursting in the air above the troops, or is it hitting the ground and then it detonating?
Hitting the ground. There was no air fuses except for flares. They exploded on impact, and the explosion scattered small pieces of shrapnel over a range of about 200 yards or 150 to 200 yards and killed anything within that range.
In the heat of battle, did you feel sympathy with the poor blighters that you were mowing down, or was it...
The only time I felt any sympathy, really, I mean, when they were attacking us, you didn't feel anything. You were just kill or be killed. So you had to kill. So it was a matter of, like I say, kill or be killed. The only time I felt any sympathy for them was when we had an airstrike. Now, the Americans, during the Korean War, and it was used in Vietnam quite extensively, they discovered napalm. And the way it was discovered was when they sent their aircraft over from Japan or Guadalcanal or whatever, they had reserve tanks on the wings. And as soon as they entered the dogfight or were in action, they used to drop these reserve tanks and fight. It made the aircraft more maneuverable. And the tanks were full of gasoline or aviation fuel, avgas. And they noticed that when they dropped these tanks, some of them exploded, hitting the ground. So somebody thought the bright idea was to put a fuse on them and use them for dropping on enemy troops. Now, the 1st Brigade over there, 27th Brigade from Hong Kong, unfortunately, a trigger-happy American dropped a few napalm bombs on the Argylls, or the Argyll and Sutherlands, and they had quite a few killed and wounded from friendly fire. Not very friendly. I used to call it blue on blue. Anyway, when they gave us support at the Imjin, we were in trenches or whatever, the aircraft came in from behind us and dropped the napalm. When they dropped it, I thought, uh-oh, another incident of friendly fire, or unfriendly fire, as the case may be. But fortunately, the lead aircraft knew what he was doing. He dropped his napalm before he reached us. It went over our heads into the Chinese. And it was a terrible weapon. It was jellyfied petrol, which flowed. If you were in a trench, it flowed into the trench and you were burnt alive. And I could smell, very similar to pork cooking, but obviously worse, sweeter, and the pain and cries of the Chinese. And at that point, I did feel sorry for them, because if it had been used against us, I'm afraid we'd have been out of our trenches and going, you know. Now, the thing about the Chinese, Brian will tell you, we weren't certain, because they came at us in waves, we weren't certain whether they were drugged or whether they coerced from behind, whether they're being driven in, and we think it was a mixture of all three and bravery, because they showed no regard for loss of life or limb.
Well, I just think it was indoctrination from the communists, like,
yes,
me, you know.
Yeah, because they had commissars behind them driving them on. And this is why I think most of those troops, Chinese troops, that were in Korea were nationalists and weren't indoctrinated into communism.
Brian, what about you? Did you see the human wave attacks where you were?
No, I didn't actually, no. But I'd seen results of napalm before the battle. They'd taken to show people had been napalmed, and it was a horrible sight. You could still see the bodies, charred bodies, and the smell was really horrible. And I don't think it'd be allowed now, health and safety, like, you know. But that was a wake-up call, that was, yeah.
But you did see some Chinese troops. Do you fire your weapon during the battle?
Yeah. As soon as we opened up, we sort of had it back, like, didn't we? As soon as you opened a Vickers up, you got blast effectors on, but they can see where you're coming from, and next minute you've got mortars and all sorts coming at you, like, you know. It's not very nice.
And what's it like discharging your weapon into groups of attacking infantrymen? Do you think about...
Well, I always think we were just trained to obey orders. Well, that was all we do. We were trained to obey what we...
And this is the question that you guys always hate.
It's a question of self-defense and survival. Kill or be killed, as plain as that.
This is the question that whenever I'm being an annoying journalist or something, and I ask guys that, you always get angry at me, but were you scared? Were you thinking, I do not want to die on this barren stretch of a Korean hillside?
The thing is, Dan, you were quite okay in action because you were busy. You didn't have time to be scared. The time you were scared is when they were preparing to attack. Now, the Chinese had very few radios, so the only contact between Chinese units was either by runner
or bugles. Bugles, yeah.
They had a lot of bugles, and then you heard the bugle call. That's when you were scared, because you knew an attack was coming in. Once the attack started, you were too busy to be scared. And it was after the battle or an attack was over, you felt relief that you made it until the next attack.
Is that true with you as well, Brian?
Well, we were just sitting, waiting, like, you know, for the next signal to go fire our guns or what, you know. But they didn't call upon us because the losses had retreated, gradually been forced back and back and back. So our fixed points in the end became useless, like, you know. So, we're in limbo, really.
Are you aware what's happening elsewhere on the battlefield? Colonel Khan making decisions? Are you aware of any of that stuff?
The only decision I remember is every man for himself. That was it, like, you know. We just had it. Well, we'd never seen a map. We just went forward and turned left, like, you know, down this valley. And it was fine as long as the Americans were strafing the hills each side, because they were fighting the death of our air power. And once that stopped, they'd open on us then, like, you know. And the Americans were supposed to be coming to relieve us or find an escape passage for us. That was blue on blue there. But, I mean, in the end, quite a few of the battalion got out. Captain Harvey's D Company and a lot of his company got out. But then once the plane stopped, we just kept on firing on us, so we dived into one of their trenches, like, and a bunker. And we thought, well, we'll wait till night, because they're very quiet then. Like, we thought we hadn't been seen, like, you know, so we waited for night. Next to me, we were surrounded by a ring of Chinese all beckoning us to come out, like, you know.
So what about you?
The thing is, Dan, I told earlier about an understatement I'd made to one of our lads on the mortars. There are quite a few of them. The second understatement, which is quite famous, was made by Brigadier Brody, the brigade commander. He was back at one of the echelons, and he was asked by a 3-star American general, what are things like on your sector, Brigadier? And his reply was, the understatement of the year, things are a bit sticky. Now, what he should have said, and I'm going to be rude now, my brigade is up shit creek without a paddle. And unfortunately, we were. Now, if he'd have said something like that, the Americans probably would have taken action sooner. But they did try to get through to us. They sent what they call a regimental combat team, which is the American equivalent of a battalion. And they couldn't make it. They couldn't get through without armored support. And the lead tank, a Centurion, was knocked out. And the thing about Centurions, they were a tank adapted at the end of World War II. Never been tried in action before. So they sent a regiment over, the 8th Hussars, which is the Gloucester Regiment of tanks. And they sent Centurion tanks, which is still on the secret list. And unfortunately, every tank, because the Centurion, the Mark at the time, was built in such a way that he could fire on the move accurately. Because normally a tank would have to stop and fire. But this tank had a stabilizing gear that it could keep it stable. And those tanks, the turrets and the essential gear was primed to be exploded if it was in danger of being captured. And that's what happened to the first tank. It got knocked out, blocked the way, so armour couldn't get through.
It wasn't tank country anyway, was it really?
So was it 3 days?
Yeah.
You held out?
Yeah. 3 days. Three long days and three very, very long nights.
Did they mostly attack at night?
Most of the attacks. You see, the Chinese, before I was captured, what happened was when we came off the hill, I didn't hear the order, but it was every man for himself. Because at the end of 3 days, we were out of ammunition, we were out of water, which is essential when you've got wounded. Food was no barrier, but water and ammunition were. I mean, to be honest, we were that short of ammunition. Brian will tell you, we were throwing rocks at them. Now, when the rocks didn't explode, the Chinese realized we weren't throwing grenades, and they knew our number was up. So,
but they mostly came at night?
Most of the attacks came at night.
And did you sleep at all?
The thing is, you see, the Chinese had a tactic, a night tactic, which we'd experienced previously. They used to send a patrol in at night, and when they got within range of our lines and we challenged them, they would reply in an English-speaking voice, "Don't shoot." So we naturally assumed they were one of our patrols coming back in who'd forgotten the password or something. But it didn't work for long because we soon got the wind of this. Now, before we were captured, the same thing happened to me. I shot a Chinaman who was ready to shoot me. He was stood up and he was pointing down at us. And on the ground beside him was a light machine gun with another Chinaman. So it was obviously the man stood up was directing the one on the ground. So I brought my rifle up and fired, and I got him. He went down, and then somebody shouted from my left in an English-sounding voice, "Don't shoot." Now, it was only at that point that I was only a young gunner, 19, I realized we weren't fighting our way out. It would have been impossible anyway. They were too far behind us. We had no ammunition left, so there was no chance of fighting our way out.
Can I ask, had you slept at all?
No.
Very little. You were two in a trench, so one slept while the other was awake, and vice versa. So you took it in turns to sleep. You took it in turns to go to the loo or whatever. And nighttime was the only time you could walk about, really. In the day, it was too dangerous. One of the things we did, when we went onto Hill 235, the hill we were last on and surrounded, is we took with us our barrels, our mortar barrels, and the sights, so the Chinese couldn't use them against us, because we had to leave in the valley where Battalion HQ was. We had to leave the base plates for the mortars and the bombs and everything like that. Although the adjutant, Captain Farrah Hockley of the Gloucesters, he did send the patrol down, a mixed patrol, down to where our vehicles were to recover as much ammunition and water as he could, which did us in good stead. It lasted us another day. But we were desperately short. And in the end, the Chinese didn't overrun us. That's one thing about it. The infantry, bless them, kept them at bay. And then the order went round, every man for himself, you leave the hill. And in the noise of battle, you don't hear things, always. And I didn't realize myself that everybody was going. And I said to my mate in the trench, where are we going? He said, south. So we all took off. And I said to my mate in the trench, I said, right, we'll try and catch our foe, the forward observation officer, because he knows the ground better than anybody, and we will get out. And one section from D Company, the officer took them north, which they didn't expect them.
Towards the Chinese.
That's right. He took them round, and 48 of them got out. But that was the most that anybody survived. The rest were either killed or taken prisoner.
Brian, had you slept at all during those 3 days?
No, not very much, no. I'm still trying to catch up. They call me Kipper.
I've heard somebody who shares a room with you says you're a bit of a snorer.
Yeah. Brian, you're snoring.
So when you tried to walk out, do you think you were going to make it, or did you...
Well, we just mesmerised. We were just surrounded by Chinese and all huddled together, like, you know, and there was... They were putting hair strikes as well in, like, you know, so we don't... We're going to get killed by our own folks, like, you know. But, I mean, we survived that anyway.
And how long were you on the run before you got captured by the Chinese?
Hours.
Not very long. A few hours, well.
Yeah.
A few hours, yeah. We just, as we say, Tommy was saying, you're just overwhelmed by numbers, like, you know. When we were hopefully waiting in this trench for nightfall to make our own way, but when the planes stopped going over, down they came, like, you know.
And how were they when they captured you?
Well, I think they were bemused, probably. They'd never done anything like that before, and we just herded together. And then, in the end, we started walking north. We didn't march. We ambled north, didn't we, really, Tom? It took us a long time. But, I mean, we used to march at night.
Well, the strange thing was, excuse me interrupting, but they were allowed us to go so far, although they were picking us off now and again, just to keep our heads down. We had four mortar barrels, and one of the things we had to do as gunners was destroy the mortar barrels before we took off the hill. So a grenade was given to four sergeants, and they were told to drop a grenade down the barrels of the mortars. And three of them were doing this, and the fourth one, as he did it, he was hit by a sniper. And that's what was happening. Fortunately, he died very quickly. He died a painless death. But on the way out, they were picking us off willy-nilly, as they wished. It was like a shooting gallery. They allowed us to go so far. And then, like I say, I shot this gentleman, went down, and we got round him and carried on. Now, suddenly, we were surrounded on either side by Chinamen. And they were young, very young Chinamen. They were almost like teenagers. And they were out of breath. And I think what had happened, the main force was driving towards Seoul, the capital, And these youngsters, they were literally youngsters, had been ordered because they don't go by vehicle, they run, because they were guerrillas. They were conducting guerrilla warfare. So they ran and cut it off. So they came down on either side, very flushed from running. You could see they'd been running. By this time, I tried to destroy my rifle. I took the bolt out, took it to bits, ammunition. I only had 4 rounds left anyway. I'd use one on this Chinaman. And if you've ever tried to destroy any old soldiers amongst you, if they ever tried to destroy a Lee Enfield 303, very difficult, a World War II weapon, the only thing I managed to damage was the sight. But I threw it away anyway because it was useless. And then the next thing, they were on us. I heard a voice shout from behind, and I've got a feeling it was the adjutant, Farah Hockley, shout, "Okay, lads, lay down your arms if you've still got any. We are captured." And then they descended on us, lined us up, and searched us for watches, anything valuable. Now, in my case, I don't know what happened to Brian, but in my case, I had a watch, which I was very proud of. I'd won it playing cards, but on the ship. Anyway, they took it from me. Well, they would have done, but I hid it. Now, we're in mixed company, so I won't tell you where I hid it. But I hid it and kept it, and I still had it in the prison camp. And you needed a watch for navigation if you escaped. But that's another story, the life in the camps. Because like Brian says, immediately after we were taken, they started pushing us north, getting us away from the front line. Because the best time, I was told later, to try and escape is when you're near your own lines, because you don't have too far to go. But of course, by the time we realized this, we were many miles north.
You're listening to Dan Snow's History. I'm talking to Korean War veterans. More coming up.
Hi, I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb. And in my podcast, Not Just the Tudors, we talk about everything from ballads to banqueting, from ghosts to gunpowder plots, from saints to sodomy. Not in other words, just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Subscribe from History Hit wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful, Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift,
You can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And also remember, when using messaging apps, they shrink the photos. You cannot print those out. You cannot blow them up. This is high quality imagery going to one of the most important people in your life. The Aura app is super easy to set up. It takes about 2 minutes and you're going to love it. There's free unlimited storage, add unlimited photos and videos, and invite as many people as you want to a frame. Right now, Aura has got a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting auraframes.com to get $30 plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AURAframes.com. Use code DANSNOW at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
How were you treated on that march and subsequent? Because so that was April 1951, you're prisoners of war. How long were you in for? 2 years?
Two and a half years.
In North Korea?
Yeah.
How were you treated on that march north and when you got to the camp?
Well, badly.
We hardly fed at all, did we, Tom? Completely alien food to what we had. I mean, they traveled very light. They had sort of bandoliers, but it was full of meal. And all they had to reconstitute that, and they'd live on that, like, you know. And we got some maize and sorghum, millet.
Well, the powder we used to call bug dust, didn't we?
Yeah. But it was appalling, really. Yeah, it was appalling, really.
The worst thing was medical attention. We had wounded men with legs missing, arms missing, and medical attention was virtually nil. Mind you, it was virtually nil amongst the Chinese. They had very little. The only thing they used to have was a kind of gel, which is a disinfectant. And if you had a headache, which was doubtful, they would put it on your head. But medical attention was zero.
Zero, yeah.
So not enough food. Was there brutality?
There was, in many cases. The frontline troops were pretty good. They knew what we'd been through, and they were expecting the same themselves. Frontline troops are kind of geared up to a kind of, not exactly neutrality, but a comradeship. You're both in the same boat. You're both literally trying to kill each other. So there's a kind of comradeship, if you like. But the further north we got, the worse the treatment became. And this happened all the way to the camp. And it took us 5 weeks to get there because it was only 500 miles, but we didn't go direct. We zigzagged because the Americans had air superiority, as you know. And the Chinese were terrified of air attacks. So we used to travel by night, hide up by day, until the further north we got and the less air activity there was.
And there were men, there were Second World War veterans who'd been captured
by the Germans and Japanese, yeah.
By the Japanese.
Yeah,
and those men, how were they going into captivity? What were their... Did they have a different response to you two?
Well, they used to give us advice, obviously. They were experienced. They'd been captured before by the Japanese, who, in my opinion, treated them worse than the Koreans. But the Koreans were bad. The North Koreans.
Because they'd been trained by the Japanese, hadn't they?
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
But then, we used to call one Jungle. He was as mad as that, or he'd been a prisoner of war with the Japanese, and XAS as well. He's a real fruitcake, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But because we never had Red Cross or anything like that, they said we could treat you better than that. But I don't think they did, really. But I mean, if we'd had Red Cross parcels, we could have made things out of the tins and things like that, couldn't we?
Well, if we'd have had Red Cross parcels, we would have been laughing because there was only a few of us compared to World War II. There was a lot of Red Cross parcels left over from World War II. But the Chinese said, no, we can look after our own prisoners. which they couldn't. They used to blame the Americans for everything, because all their supplies came across the Yellow River, which was a natural brown boundary between North Korea and China. And they used to bring stuff over the bridges, which the Americans were obviously continually bombing. And if there was no mail, the Chinese would blame the Americans. They hated the Americans like the plague.
Well, they tried to indoctrinate us. We used to get, every ordinary day used to be harangued by them with about the American imperialists and all this crap, like, you know, about they were using germ warfare and things like this. And of course, you get selective hearing in the end. You just switch off, don't you?
I've hogged you for too long, and I'm going to let everyone ask a question in a second, but I've got one last question to ask. You'll forgive me, everyone. I'm being very selfish. You both seem very well-adjusted, happy, cheerful people. You seem like it.
My dad said to me, when he knew I was going to career, my dad said two things. Keep the sense of humour, whatever happens, and keep your head down. Well, I couldn't keep my head down, but I kept my sense of humour. We used to take the mickey out the Chinese, something rotten. I was only telling a couple of months ago, the American
ambassador
came to Gloucester, and Dickie asked me to tell him about the story of the digging of holes. When we were in the camp, we used to walk dogs round, imaginary dogs, look up at the sky for hours on end, and get crowds of Chinese looking up with us. Nothing there. Nothing there. Except the occasional dogfight with the MiGs from China. But one of the things we used to do is crazy. It's boredom, you see, because every day was the same occasionally. Although I did try to escape, but I didn't even get out the camp. But that's another story. But what we used to do, we'd dig a hole, right? Quite deep over there, 200 yards away, we'd dig another hole. The dirt from that hole, we would put in that hole, and vice versa. The Chinese thought we were trying to dig our way out. And they'd come and say, why do you do this? Why do you do? Keep it quiet, keep it quiet. So they were mystified and used to walk away shaking their heads. These crazy British, you know.
And is that what's enabled you to remain happy and well-adjusted people, the comradeship and trying to find the sense of humour in these situations?
We made playing cards out of bits of paper we got. And I learned to play bridge over there as well, like, you know, bridge, crib and whist and all sorts of things. Like,
every,
you know,
cloud, so.
Is it, the thing is, Dan, on the march up, you were okay if you kept with the main body. But if you got separated, like some of the wounded did, they were treated appallingly because they fell into North Korean hands. And in fact, when we were in the prison camps, the older men amongst us, the wise men, the old sweats, the reservists, used to tell us, if you manage to escape and you want to give yourselves up, which was more likely, because it was very, very difficult to escape, being white. At one time, I got yellow jaundice. And the medic who saw to me, a corporal, said, Tommy, now is the time to escape. I said, why? He said, because you got yellow jaundice. He was joking, of course. But what he meant was, it was pointless trying to pelt yourself off as a Korean. It was hopeless.
Well, they'd say the wrong coloured eyes, wrong coloured hair, and their appearance as well. You know, no chance, like, you know.
Gents, I've got to let the audience ask some questions now. Thank you very much indeed. We've got a roving microphone, and we can hear more from these gentlemen. Let's put a hand up if you... I'm sure we've got lots of hands. There you go. Well done, sir. Straight out of the...
Yeah, my question's about George Blake indirectly, because I think George Blake was recruited in one of the camps. And was he with you? Was he in the same camp as you? How many camps were there? And it's great to hear the kind of regimental spirit turn their efforts to turn you, met with derision, but were some tempted?
Some people flirted with communism and thought this would be
a good idea. Well, that was the trouble. Quite shortly after we were captured and in the camps, I mean, nowadays they talk of radicalization. So I suppose in a way they tried to radicalize us. They tried indoctrination. They took it upon themselves, the English-speaking commissars, to try and indoctrinate us and convince us that communism was the best thing since sliced bread, an old cliche, I know. But we could see through it. And we used to take the mickey out of them terribly. But they used to like it, because if you argued with them, they assumed you were interested. So we used to tone it down a bit. But anyway, Anthony Farrell Hockley, the adjutant, he was a past master, and he used to get on their nerves terribly. He tried to escape 5 times. Each time, he was brought back. And what the Chinese used to do, and in fact, they were quite within their right to shoot you if you escaped. So you were always conscious, when you escaped, of getting a bullet in the back, which is what happened to me. I didn't get a bullet in the back, obviously, I'm still here. But I was always conscious of it happening. And what happened to me is I was recaptured. I tried to escape with a man called Dave Green, who was in the Gloucesters. I forget which company. Brian may know.
Oh, I can't remember.
No, I can't. I think it was B Company. I'm not sure. Anyway, we were recaptured, and I'm afraid if you did something wrong, you were put on the naughty step the Chinese had. I think they invented it way back. And I'm afraid we were punished, because we were charged, strangely enough, with abusing Chinese hospitality. Brian will tell you, you had to make a confession. And we used to take the mickey out of them terribly. And if you did it quick enough, even the good English-speaking commissar couldn't understand you. But occasionally, they got the gist. We would sing songs like Mao Zedong, Hu Flung Dong at Mao Zedong. And of course, the Chinese picked it up, occasionally. And of course, the consequence was pretty dire. And we had one man in the camp called Derek Kinney. And again, Brian will tell you, he was a real headache to the Chinese. And in fact, he was there to avenge his brother, who was in the Middlesex Regiment and had been killed when the war started back in 1950. So he joined the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers to avenge his brother. Anyway, he was captured, and he ended up being awarded the George Cross for his bravery whilst a prisoner. But of course, he used to stir them up. And when he stirred them up, they stayed stirred up for days, you know, and we bore the consequences. But anyway,
were you physically beaten?
Yes, we were physically beaten, because if you escaped and you were recaptured, which was the case, nobody escaped, only one man who didn't come back. Because what the Chinese used to do, if they got an escapee and they shot him, they would bring his body back to the camp and say to you, they'd line us up and say, look, this is what happens if you try to escape. You get shot. So not many people did try it, but Fal Hawkley tried five times. And if any man could succeed, he could, but he didn't. And you were punished very much.
Let's get another couple of questions in. Gentleman there.
Hi, thank you very much. You mentioned previously that the Koreans treated you differently as prisoners, noticeably worse, because they were trained by the Japanese. Did they fight differently as well? Could you tell when you were facing maybe a Chinese battalion which just sort of runs screaming at you against a Korean battalion? Did they fight differently? Did they use different weapons, different tactics?
Did you face the North Koreans in battle?
No.
Or was it always Chinese?
Chinese. There were a few North Koreans, but very few. At that stage, in 51, the North Koreans had been defeated and were no longer relevant. The Chinese controlled North Korea completely.
Brilliant. Right, next one. Here we go. Yep, gentlemen, further up there. Here we go.
I was just wondering about the circumstances of your release from captivity. Whether you, how far you knew in advance it might be happening, or what were the circumstances, or how you felt at the time of your release?
It was a prisoner exchange. We used to go, we all assembled eventually nearer the border where the demarcation line is now. Then we'd wait for us to be named, and then we would go, what we call Freedom Bridge, we'd pass each other, and they'd be throwing off their stuff the Americans had given them.
And Brian, did you know that you were about, I mean, the war obviously petered out, didn't it?
Dan, immediately after we were taken prisoner, shortly afterwards in June, July, peace talks started. So we thought, great, we'll be home by Christmas. No chance. A bit like John Lewis, you know, never opened before Christmas. And eventually, in 53, we started to realize we were being better treated. The first year was the worst. Hardly any good treatment at all. The second year was bad enough. The third year, we started to be treated better. We got, Brian will tell you, a small goodie bag from the Red Cross. Toothbrushes, soap, things we take for granted, we got after 3 years in prison. And then, one morning in August, I think it was, no, June, July, we were assembled on what we called a square. It was the mud patch. The Chinese surrounded us with guards, with fixed bayonets. And we thought, oh God, we're for the chop. Anyway, the commandant came along, spoke Chinese for half an hour. And my mate said to me, he knew a bit of Chinese, he said, he keeps talking about the peace talks. Now, whether the peace talks had broken down or whether they were coming to an end, we didn't know. But anyway, the interpreter got up and said those magic words we'd heard many times on the films in World War II. For you, the war is over. And we just stood still, not uttering a sound. We didn't murmur, we didn't utter a word. The Chinese were baffled, and afterwards they said, why didn't you rejoice? Because all of a sudden the Americans got the word and we heard big cheers coming from the American compound. And we said, because, to be honest, we didn't believe you. You've told us that many lies when you tried to indoctrinate us. We thought you were having us on. And strangely enough, because of indoctrination, the peace talks had decided that whoever wanted to could stay, either in Korea or go to China and live a normal life. About 12 Brits agreed to this. About 150 Americans agreed to this. But gradually, the Brits changed their minds.
Only one went.
And only one man, a Marine called Condren, decided He wanted to go to China, and indeed he did. And we believe, we're not certain, but we believe he married a Japanese girl in China and raised a family, and apparently he sneaked back into England years later and got out again quickly, because obviously they were liable for prosecution, for treason or whatever. But Brian will tell you there were probably about 12 who sided with the Chinese. Anyway, that's enough.
That's a wonderful place to finish, but I've got one last question. You both volunteered for this. Do you regret it? Brian?
Well, it's been a wonderful experience looking home.
No, not tonight.
No. I only meant tonight.
You both volunteered to go to that war.
Oh, yeah.
Do you regret it?
Well, initially I did, but when I went back, I said I would never go back. Well, I went back, I think it was in 86, I think it was, and I couldn't believe what they'd done, the Koreans, in that space of time. You know, I went up to the hotel and had an iPad then. I put it on the table and I thought, I'll try emailing home, like, you know. I was straight in, like, you know. I couldn't believe it, like, you know. I think, we're still going to get Wi-Fi home, like, you know.
Well, that's Gloucestershire for you.
So,
okay, so seeing it today, how developed it is, that made it worth it. What about you? Do you regret it?
Absolutely not.
No. We go over there and they treat us like gods, they do.
Well, I did for many years regret it for the sake of relatives, next of kin, loved ones, you name it, who had lost people in the war. The worst thing we saw, really, was the fate of refugees in Korea.
Yeah, that was the... That
terrible, when, especially yeah, when, during when, the winter.
When Afghan it came flooding back again, when the yeah. Afghans were trying to get out of Afghan, like, you know, and it just come back because we were dug in beside the railway and they were just flooding through. Hanging onto the train, one train line there, and they were all hanging onto the sides, on the roof, everything, just to escape.
But now you don't regret.
Well, it's the same in most wars, as you know. Civilians suffer the worst, and they did suffer really badly, because the Koreans had come down, gone back, North Koreans. The Chinese had come down and gone back. I mean, Seoul itself changed hands about 4 times.
But just quickly, if you know now what you know and what you went through, you go back and talk to that 19-year-old, would you tell him to go or stay in the UK? Looking back.
Well, looking back, yes, because it was the start of my army career. I'm glad it happened then, because it geared me up, really. I mean, when we came back, I'll be quite honest.
Do you know what? We should stop, because these people have all got talks to go to. I'm so sorry. It's my fault. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. What a...
Thanks, Dan.
All this tradition of ours, our school history, our songs, this part of the history of our country, all were gone and finished.
Thanks, folks. You've reached the end of another episode. Hope you're still awake. Appreciate your loyalty, sticking through to the end. If you fancied doing us a favour here at History Hit, I would be incredibly grateful if you would go and wherever you get these pods, give it a little rating, 5 stars or its equivalent. A review would be great. Please head over there and do that. It really does make a huge difference. It's one of the funny things the algorithm loves to take into account. So please head over there and do that. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Dan Snow's History Hit. Please follow this show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget you can also listen to all of these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of TV documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can also get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use code DANSNOW at checkout.